Good morning. Happy Monday. Happy Leafs finish off the Senators day. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. We kind of did. It's Jay's Talk Plus. It's Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz. I had a nice Saturday. Jay's got banged. So I, no rush, got to Ice Nine Kills and Limp Bizkit and Metallica, which was really great. I went with Matt Bonner, my Raptors co-host. So this is where the bar is set for co-host activity. We did drag brunch. He countered with Metallica and Limp Bizkit. Balls in your court now as you guys fight for my love, like when my parents got divorced. How was your weekend?
God, happy Monday, Blake Murphy.
You're going to go 10 games in a row without scoring any runs and expect me to open the show cheery?
No, listen, it's fair. I just I didn't expect to have to fight for your love on this Monday morning, but I will if I have to, which is, you know, more than we can say for the Blue Jays.
Hopefully you put up a better fight than getting blanked in a doubleheader and dropping 7 of the last 8. They finished that road trip 1-for-5. If you missed it on the weekend, fun one Friday.
Yeah, it was.
They come back in the 9th. Alejandro Kirk comes through with a big hit. Devin Williams gets chased so badly that he loses the closer role. And then Sunday rolls around and the Blue Jays lose a pair to the Yankees to fall to 13-15, 1-7 over their last 8. And to put into context just how weak the offense has been, I had this memory of, well, some of the stuff we're talking about the last week or two, we really talked about last year. Whether it's, you know, 2023 was the runners in scoring position year, 2024 was the home run differential year. And I was like, somewhere in there, there was a long streak of not scoring more than 4 runs, because the Jays are currently on a 10-game streak of scoring 4 runs or fewer. And that might seem like a low bar, but only 2 teams in baseball this year have longer streaks. San Diego did it. They're still a pretty good team. Kansas City went 17 games.
Yeah.
That's why they're the only team that has fewer home runs than the Blue Jays still. But even the last 2 years, when we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about the limitations of the offense, they didn't have a streak like this. This is the longest streak since 2001 the Blue Jays have had without putting up a big number in a game.
It's tough. It's tough even, you know, when you put it into context like that, Blake, and when we look at where we were last year at this time, it's surprising to me that the Blue Jays actually had a better record at this time last year than they do this season, but already...
That's not encouraging.
But already there was a ton of talk about, you know, where is this offense going? There was the no-hitter followed by the one-hitter in Houston, and the problems were so visible back then. This was the offseason to address it, and that happened via personnel, that happened via bringing in someone like Anthony Santander. It's just not working, and it's not like we haven't seen it at all. I think that is what maybe even increases the frustration a little bit. It's that we see it in flashes. We see it come and go, and Santander, in my mind, has sort of become the best illustration for that, because when he swings like he did to Homer in game 2 yesterday, it's a pretty swing. It's his pitch. Everything is going according to plan. And that is who Anthony Santander can be when he, you know, gets going, when he is playing his game, his brand of hitting. But there has been no consistency. For whatever reason, he just can't find it. And that's, you look at this Blue Jays offense up and down, that's exactly it. We have seen flashes from the bottom of the lineup, showing up in the big moments, coming up with singles, and then stealing bases, and then helping the Blue Jays eke out or scrap out a couple of runs in an inning to win a game. We have seen Vladimir Guerrero Jr. hit the doubles and hit the home runs and just, you know, stay aggressive in the zone, look for his pitch to hit. We have seen that. We've seen Bo Bichette, you know, send the line drives down the first baseline or the third baseline. We've seen all of that in flashes, and then it just disappears. And I think we saw 2 extremes as well of the Blue Jays offense in that doubleheader, in that they had 11 hits in one game and scored 2 runs, and then the hits just disappeared in game 2.
Yeah, it's it really could snapshot the 2 different ways in which they've been frustrated. Look, baseball's a weird sport. It's a long season. Every team is going to find weird ways to lose some games. The San Francisco Giants walked the game off yesterday with a little league home run, a 58-mile-an-hour dribbler between the pitcher and third base that got thrown away at first and then thrown away at third. Heliot Ramos gets to go all the way around the base, doesn't even get an RBI for his walk-off. Poor Luke Jackson on the Texas Rangers, by the way, gets hit with a loss for that one. He threw one pitch and it got dribbled between third base and the mound. So there, look, weird stuff can happen. Nothing is going to be consistent for 162 games. However, as we've talked about on our show, as we talked about on Blue Jays Talk yesterday after the game, this is not, the Jays don't get to lean on, it's a 28-game sample, it's early. Maybe that's true for Anthony Santander, who we haven't seen in a Blue Jays uniform before, although he is historically a slow starter. But this is, when you look at the team level, this is multiple years of this. It started creeping in 2023 when there were the runners in scoring position issues. That normalized a little bit, but they didn't hit it for enough power that year, and then the offense was nothing in the two-game wildcard series. 2024, the offensive issues persisted basically until they pulled the plug on the season and sold a bunch of pieces off at the deadline. So when we look at this, it's like, yeah, we know Vlad's going to be a little better, Bo's going to be a little better, but there was a lot of context prior to this year informing how we're evaluating these 28 games. If this were a team that had been a top five offense last year, I would probably be very comfortable being like, it's early, they'll come out of it. They were not a top five offense last year. They had the second worst home run differential in all of baseball last year. And right now they are so out in front of everyone in terms of negative home run differential. They have been out homered by 22 home runs already.
That's just,
it's only 28 games.
Yeah, that's not okay. That is not acceptable for a team trying to make the playoffs.
It's not. And not only make the playoffs, but I know that generally we talk about like playoff style baseball of good pitching and good defense, and you got to be able to string some hits together and play small ball. And that's true. If you're in a tie game in the eighth inning and you're against these elite bullpens, you might have to scrape one across however you need to. If you look at the last 10 years of Major League Baseball playoffs, though, the absolute best predictor of who's going to win a series is who wins the home run battle, because pitching is so good. You are going to the bullpens earlier where everyone is just throwing 1,000%. Every single time, you have got to be able to get into one here and there to win playoff baseball. So this is, obviously, it's a huge issue right now in terms of getting to the playoffs because the Blue Jays are just not playing well, period. When you get outscored 33-9 on a six-game road trip, it's bleak. But even if you are of the mind, they're going to be better. They'll pitch well enough to get to the playoffs. And if you're a super optimistic Blue Jays fan, even then, the way that this offense is built, at least the way it looks right now, is also not a playoff-style offense, given what we've seen the last decade of playoff baseball. So a lot of reasons to be concerned about the cold start.
Can you imagine what this offense could be? And this may just be just me, you know, tapping into the happy Monday feeling.
We are having different Monday mornings.
The beginning of this show. But can you imagine what this offense could be if you had guys, you know, scraping out the singles as we had seen earlier on in the season, and then you had a legitimate, consistent power bat in there to drive those runs in? It's funny to me that, you know, we thought that this guy was going to be Anthony Santander. We thought that Vladdy had figured something out last year that was going to carry over to 2025. And, you know, with Bo Bichette being healthy, the Blue Jays bet so much on just those guys figuring it out and, you know, bringing in some new energy for this season. It just hasn't happened, Blake. And that is where people start to look at the offseason and, you know, really point a finger at, we could have addressed this, we didn't.
And it's something that got talked about all offseason. It's not a surprise issue. And this is where some of the calls we got on Jay's Talk yesterday, you know, frustration that they're not doing anything to change it yet. Well, they came into the season knowing that this was going to be an issue. They navigated the offseason. The Ross Atkins quote at the end of last season about power being low hanging fruit is going to, you know, it's going to be hanging on a banner somewhere at some point.
Yeah.
And you mentioned yes, what if they could string hits together like they had been doing for a little bit? They have now fallen down, by the way. They're now league average in batting average. At least early on, that was the one thing they were doing pretty well. They were hitting for contact. They were hitting for good average. They're now league average. They're bottom five in slugging. They're bottom five in home runs. They're bottom five in runs per game. And you mentioned, what would it look like if those two things happened together? They're still stuck on one home run with runners in scoring position. They are the worst hitting team in baseball in terms of hitting for extra bases with runners in scoring position. They have a 0.52 isolated slugging. So what that means is they're hitting .233, and then they're only slugging .285. So I used the comp earlier in the season, very tongue-in-cheek, that they are hitting with runners in scoring position basically to Munenori Kawasaki's career batting league, which Great figure, great personality, not the batting line you want an entire team to have with runners in scoring position. Even when we adjust for like park factors and quality of pitching and things like that, there's still a bottom five offense with runners in scoring position. There are so many ways to cut how shaky a team they are right now. And back to your initial point, that was game one.
Yep.
A bunch of hits. I think they went 2-for-13 with runners in scoring position.
Correct.
Stranded 11 base runners. And then game two, it was just nothing at all. They just couldn't get hits over. Clark Schmidt struggled with his control. They couldn't take advantage. Yeah. And in both of these games, something happened that we talked about after the Ronel Blanco start against the Astros, which is you had an opportunity early before a pitcher got comfortable, before a pitcher found it. Max Fried is Max Fried. But the first two innings of that game, one on Saturday, he did not look like Max Fried.
Two wild pitches, allowing Bo Bichette to sort of just run through the bases.
An error in the field as well. Basically handed you a run, and then the bases were loaded,
yeah,
and you weren't able to get anything. He threw 27 pitches in the first inning. The second inning, he struggled a little bit too. And then, third inning, he's Max Fried again. You missed your opportunity. Clark Schmidt comes in with an ERA over 7, fresh off the IL after two starts. A much better pitcher than that, but clearly a guy who hasn't found it yet coming back from injury. He struggles early, walks a couple guys. You can't get anything across the board meaningfully then either. And then suddenly he's able to settle in and they give him a quick hook because you didn't get the Max Fried when he had the pitch count early. So the Yankees are entering game two with a fully rested bullpen. All their leverage arms were off Saturday, didn't get used in game one. So, you know, you really, the poor execution early against Max Fried really did just like keep rolling as the doubleheader went on.
I had to go back to game day on MLB.com, Blake, and take a look at what happened inning by inning, because I was just baffled by looking at the box score and seeing 11 hits and 2 runs. How do you explain 11 hits and scoring only 2 runs? Well, you explain it by looking at a bunch of leadoff singles that lead nowhere. And yeah, the Blue Jays had a couple of hits in a couple of innings, and then they couldn't do anything with it. And we saw some really poor at-bats in those situations. It's not even like, you know, they had to put up a fight and the pitcher was really making his pitches and making it difficult for the offense. Yes, there were some of those moments. I don't want to take anything away from Yankees pitching here, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of the time the Blue Jays had runners on first and second because they put together a couple of quick singles to begin the inning, and then nothing. And then we saw some very, very non-competitive at-bats. I know that this wasn't game one, but game two, you mentioned Clark Schmidt walking a couple of guys with one out, and Andrés Giménez, George Springer both come in, and they're just chasing awful pitches out of the zone, just clearly, you know, breaking balls that were never really close. And you know, I understand that if you can't pick up on the spin right away, if the breaking ball is really tight, it does make it a little bit difficult for you to recognize it. But this is just, it's been going on for a little too long for us to look at it and you know, give them that much of the benefit of the doubt, especially in those situations, especially against a division rival. You need to be better, and it's just been a lot of non-competitive at bats, Blake. I know you and I have discussed a little bit on this show before the Blue Jays issues were early in the count, and Chris Black also had a Twitter thread about that that was very, very informative. And the one thing that stood out to me in that, it's that it's not just the home runs that took a dip from year by year. We all saw the chart on the broadcast about, you know, where the Blue Jays were in home runs a few years ago and where they are now in terms of major league rankings. But that's also the case for early count success for the Blue Jays. They used to be number one, right? In 21 and 22. And that also took a dip over the years. And that was very much on display in this doubleheader against the Yankees.
It was. And it's, you know, Bo Bichette's probably the best example of that because he's a guy we think of as a good early count hitter, someone who is aggressive with a purpose, even if it means more chase and things like that. We can look at this. I know there was a lot of talk about the bottom of the order and how 5 through 9, the Jays aren't getting enough. You know, I just got a question on Twitter. How come the Yankees are hitting so well and the Yankees juggled their order a bunch of times over the course of the series? And I get it. It's a great question from Rob C. And the answer, part of the answer at least, is the Yankees have a lot of guys who are hitting well right now. So you can mix and match Trent Grisham and Ben Rice and Paul Goldschmidt and Cody Bellinger wasn't hitting well before this weekend, but you have pieces. If you're the Toronto Blue Jays, you have George Springer who you could promote, and then you have a hole in the four spot. And who else, 5 through 9, are you arguing right now would be better suited to hit at the top of the order? Like, at this point, I'm all for changing the batting order, but you're doing it because you want to shake things up and just try to loosen something up, not because someone down the order is having a Trent Grisham out of nowhere 7 home runs in a part-time role season, a Ben Rice forced into duty with Giancarlo Stanton on the IL and overperforming or performing to, you know, everything you'd hope for. You don't have that guy down in the order. So where I was going with that is there was a lot of consternation in the text line and on the phone line last night about the bottom part of the order. And the Blue Jays are 20th in OPS that they're getting from 5th to 9th in the order. That's below average, but it's not. I think people would probably say it feels closer to like 28th, 29th, right. 30th. They're not getting a lot. The bigger issue is they're 26th in what they're getting from the top 3 spots in the order.
That's the actual issue here, yes. Let's be honest.
Including 27th in slugging and 29th in home runs. Only Kansas City has gotten fewer home runs out of the top 3 hitters in their order. Vlad went 3 for 21 this weekend. Weirdly, I looked up the numbers this morning. I thought for sure I was going to see that his chase rate was up. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's right in line with the last couple of years. Weirdly, he's swinging less on pitches in the zone. So whether that's being overly selective on good stuff, he's really struggled with breaking balls and off-speed stuff early on here. It's a weird one. I would have guessed that he was chasing a little more because a couple of those at-bats over the weekend, and I know he hit a home run on Friday, and that was nice to see, but a couple of those ones, breaking balls low and away, just kind of offering at it in a way that wasn't super competitive.
And we saw him also work a couple of 3-ball counts, 3-0 counts, and just stare at a pitch in the zone in the next offering, and then the pitcher would flip a breaking ball, and that's the one that he would swing at, and then all of a sudden it's 3-2, you've lost your advantage. So I don't know, Blake, if it is a matter of being overly selective in those situations and then all of a sudden pressing because you no longer have the 3-0 advantage, or if it's just, you know, approach, game plan. Is he not seeing the ball as well as we think he is or was? It's so tough to put a finger on it.
Yeah, and again, like, it's like the chase rate isn't super high up. It's more, you know, when we dig into the numbers, it's more he's not jumping on the good stuff in the zone so much as he's chasing bad stuff out of it. But those are missed opportunities. And, you know, his OPS is kicking in at 760. That's not where it needs to be. It's better than it was this time last year, which that's not necessarily encouraging, but people keep doing the Santander, he's a slow starter thing. Vlad kicked it into high gear around this time last year. Maybe it's just taking a little bit. So that's one of the 3 guys at the top of the order that's underperforming. And again, 760 OPS, not terrible, but you just signed a $500 million. The bar that we evaluate you with is much higher. Anthony Santander, we've talked about a lot. The fact that he is now tied for the team lead with 3 home runs through 28 games. There are 98 players in baseball right now who have more home runs than any Blue Jay.
And that includes just some really
Trent Grisham has
numbers.
7.
Weird names, I mean. Such as Trent Grisham in a part-time role. Again, he's not playing every day.
And then the other name in that top three, Bo Bichette, is hitting .292. Mm-hmm. But it is a very empty .292 at this point. He has no home runs, no triples. He is 154th out of 165 qualified hitters in isolated slugging. So how much you're adding on top of your batting average with extra bases. And he only has 5 walks. Also, they didn't end up being consequential, but 2 throwing errors on Sunday. What are you seeing from Bo in terms of, I don't know, the contact profile is still kind of there, but it's a lot of empty .292 right now.
Yeah, and to me, that is the most head-scratching development, I would say, from the top three, because we had been talking about Santander pretty much since the season started. We spoke about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. until he hit his first homer, and then, you know, maybe things started to normalize a little bit, but you know, obviously there's still, he needs to produce more. But with Bo, through all of that, he was the guy that, you know, we weren't necessarily worried about because he was the producer early on. He is the leader on this team in RBIs right now. So, and that was obviously when the top of the order was producing, which is it's not anymore. And maybe that is why we are seeing a little bit more of empty calories in what he's doing, because he's still making contact, like you said. He's still reaching base. He's still doing those things, but it's not coming on moments that matter. Whereas early on, it did come on moments that matter.
Well, it's also just not, even if it were moments that matter, like you can't be a full-time leadoff hitter, especially if you're thinking as him, if you're in a walk year, you're in a free agent year. Like a 292 average is good.
Yeah.
686 OPS is not enough from a leadoff player, right. Not enough from a guy who's going to hit at the top of your order. Like, even if your singles were very timely, like, sure, if he had like 30 RBI right now, I'd be like, okay, you know what? I'll take, if you're only going to hit those singles in big spots, but you know, you're the leadoff guy, so you can't expect that you're going to have a ton of RBI opportunity. You're never going to have one at the start of the game. It's going to be the bottom of the order hitting ahead of you. Bo Bichette needs to give them a little, and he doesn't. I don't think the 29 home runs from 2021 are coming back.
Yeah.
But more of a doubles threat, more of at least a nominal home run threat, because especially as long as he's in the leadoff spot, you're okay with Bo not taking a lot of walks because that's who he is. That's his identity as a hitter. But a sub 700 OPS in any of those top four spots in the order just isn't going to be enough.
Oh, 100%. You know, what I mean, though, is because he was producing, you kind of didn't really worry about him, because through all of the talk of power is going to come, don't worry, we're good, we're trusting the process and all of that, Bo was the easiest guy to believe in that for, because one, he was injured for most of last year, and so a slower start is more or less justified because of the time that he's missed. I'm not trying to make excuses, but he was not the guy that I was pointing my finger at and being concerned about. One, because of that. Two, because he was still producing. And three, because he's not necessarily a home run guy. His power comes in a little bit of a different way. And as long as he was making good contact, I believed that the doubles would eventually come.
He was also, like, hitting better at that point, right? Like, this is the other thing is, like, we weren't talking as negatively about it or as concerned about the production from that spot because he was hitting better. He hasn't, what is it? He's gone 9 games without an extra base hit now.
Yeah.
And the batting average has mostly stayed where it is. It's dropped from 313 to 292 in that stretch, but you're still pretty happy with 292. But yeah, we're talking 9 games without an extra base hit. That's why we weren't talking about it two weeks ago.
It's just so funny how quickly things flip. It's one bad road trip. And then now, yeah, there is real reason to look at Bo Bichette and maybe be concerned. I think, honestly, Blake, everyone on that team will benefit from just coming back home, taking a day off, and trying again tomorrow. And again, obviously, there is a ton of reason for concern right now. It's so difficult to buy into the discourse of it will come when it's been 2 years and change of this now. But yeah, I think everyone is probably pretty happy to just come back to Toronto at this point.
Yeah, it will come in the sense that they won't be the second worst offense in baseball, probably, but it won't come in the way that like there's no path to this group being a top five offense. So unfortunately, when you're a playoff hopeful team and you have the fifth highest payroll, we're going to grade you with a tougher rubric than the Kansas City Royals or Colorado Rockies are getting graded on. And yeah, by the way, here comes Garrett Crochet on Tuesday. So yeah, you know, you mentioned the kind of talking point that they'll use. And John Schneider gave one to Shai Davidi after the game. You can read the whole piece at sportsnet.ca. But we know that we have the guys in there that can do it. It's easy to look at it and say the sky is falling, and it's not. We have good players. Yes, they do. But I think even the optimistic lenses, you could get back to being an average-ish offense and win based on the quality of your pitching and the quality of your run prevention. That is how this team's built. But it also means if you are built as an average offense when things are going well, that the floor is lower. And that's what we're seeing over these last couple games here. Final one, just a note. Jonathan Clase was sent back down. He was the 27th man in the doubleheader yesterday. The Blue Jays will have to make another roster move tomorrow because Dalton Varsho is expected to come off the IL. He has gone 3-for-25 with no extra base hits and no walks in his 7 minor league rehab games, but he was able to play center field in 4 of those, played a complete game in center field yesterday. So seems like he's physically ready, if not, I mean, we don't look a ton at the rehab stint numbers, but it's not, I don't know, someone who texted in, sorry, PD Alex texted in and had Varsho at the top of his like hypothetical lineup. a sub 300 OBP guy who just went 3 for 25 on a rehab assignment and hasn't played in a couple months. I'm not throwing that guy at the top of the batting order. Yeah, no. We will talk about that one more tomorrow. Yes. Maybe we'll have an idea of who is going down with Dalton Varsho coming back. We can also kick that one around and debate it. Right now, we're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, talk about some good baseball teams that are playing well. We'll talk to John Morosi about everything that happened in Major League Baseball around the weekend. We'll talk a little bit more Jays as well. John Morosi joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Excited for the first time this season to have back on one of our favorite guests, John Morosi of MLB Network, of NHL Network. John, good morning. How we doing, man? Nice to see you.
Blake and Julia, I'm doing great. My understanding is this is the support line for those who had their players frustrated with officiating against New York teams yesterday. Am I correct about that between the Pistons and the Jays?
Yeah. You, Tim Hardaway, Kevin Gausman, we're all just lined up here. I couldn't believe the ump scorecards that came out this morning. And it was like, oh, it's plus one run Blue Jays in that one. It doesn't feel that way. Similar. We'll get the last 2 minute report today, John, on that Pistons game. The refs have already admitted that should have been a foul. So I'm sorry for you on that one, but fun series at least.
It's been a fun series, a small consolation indeed. And it is just speaking as a Detroiter, Michigander, watching the Pistons play. I'm not quite sure where they are, if you're talking about comparable levels to where the Raptors were on their journey to a championship, but they are a fun team to watch again. Cade is a superstar. The personalities that they've really brought this basketball community together again, reminded everybody what a great basketball town Detroit can be and is. So just to see all the familiar faces around the arena and a really fun team to watch. And again, they've been a couple plays away from this easily being 3-1 to Detroit. So we'll see. Maybe this is like, for those that have followed the NBA for a long time, there was a classic series between Detroit and the Knicks back in the mid-80s where they actually had to play Game 5 at Joe Louis Arena because of a roof collapse of the Silverdome. This is a number of buildings ago now for the Pistons, but that was the great Bernard King and Isaiah Thomas matchup that foreshadowed the championships to come. So maybe that is what we're experiencing now, and maybe the Leafs will close out a 3-1 lead themselves here against the Sens.
And Joe Louis, a fitting one for that Knicks-Pistons series that has gotten very physical. And if Isaiah Stewart gets back in the mix at any point here, it's going to get real physical. Okay, let's pivot to baseball.
Yes.
John, I mostly want to do kind of a whip around the MLB with you here. But before we do, how are you feeling? Can you believe that we're back here again having the same conversations about the Jays already this year that we were having the bulk of the last 2 years when it comes to their offense?
Yeah, there was a brief moment in time there at the beginning of the year where the Jays were at or near the top of the division where I was a bit more optimistic and bullish about this lineup. I think you look at George Springer's renaissance, and that probably has been the key upbeat story for the Jays, or when Jimenez was really going for the first couple weeks. But that's obviously changed. Still waiting on the power surge from Santander. Still waiting for Bo to really pick up and be the player that he's been a lot. And I listened a lot to your show and the conversation that you and Julia have had, Blake, about where this lineup could set up. And I do think the absence of a leadoff hitter with true leadoff skills has become more and more obvious, to where I concur with a lot of the conversations that you've had about Bo being a better fit in the second spot, but they just don't have the personnel right now for that to be the case. So it's been a concern. You hope that maybe Varsho coming back in will give them a boost, but there's just too many quick and seemingly empty at-bats for this team. The one silver lining, though, is that in the American League East, they're actually not even the most disappointing team. That distinction belongs to the Orioles right now. And no team has really run away with this. The Yankees with their bullpen concerns and Devin Williams, and certainly that weekend series would feel a lot differently had the Jays not come back and won that series opener there on Friday. So I think the Jays, yes, they're flawed. Yes, it's a very similar conversation to last year, but the division has not run away from them yet. And that is one note of positivity for the Jays and their fans.
John, you mentioned the Yankees' bullpen struggles, Devin Williams, you know, being removed from that closer role pretty early in the season, pretty early in his Yankees tenure here. You know, kind of funny that Alejandro Kirk was the guy who delivered the final blow for that to happen. Someone who has had a pretty notable slow start to the season. But what do you make of the decision to pull Williams from that role? Luke Weaver now coming into close games for the Yankees.
Well, Julia, certainly it's not the way the Yankees drew it up in spring training or when they gave up some real assets to acquire Williams from the Brewers during the course of the offseason. I do think this is a move that you can make when you're Aaron Boone. He of course, just got his contract extension, so he's on solid ground. And also, Luke Weaver is under contract for longer than Devin Williams. Williams is 1 year. And so if you're starting slowly in the 1 year of your deal and you've got someone there who's done the job before in the playoffs and helped you get to a World Series a year ago, it's an easy, tough decision is what I would describe that as. It's an easy, tough decision. You've got an option right there. Williams clearly is not the player that he's been, at least. And again, this could be one mechanical fix and he's back to being himself. But it's asking a lot of someone to work through your mechanics as the closer of the New York Yankees, where you're getting a lot of save opportunities, struggling in them. Your changeup is not at all the pitch that it's been in the past. It's a worry. Honestly, there's almost a mirror image to what the Phillies have been going through with Romano, where they just can't find a way to get him back to being himself yet, and you almost have to keep moving into lower and lower leverage situations for that to be the case, unless there's an injury that would explain it. It doesn't appear that's the case right now with Devin and the Yankees, but I think Weaver is a really nice fill-in for that role at the moment. I still look at this Yankees roster, Julia, and consider the pitching side of things. There's no more Clay Holmes. There's no more Tommy Canley. They've both signed elsewhere. You traded for Williams. He hasn't been himself. You look at the rotation. You've got no Gerrit Cole. Heel's had his injuries. It's a pretty ordinary pitching staff right now. They're not awful, but it's no longer the group that carried them to the World Series a year ago. So I think Aaron Boone's got a lot of work to do. I, for one, am waiting for the Red Sox to show themselves to be the best and most talented team in this division. I think that's what I'm seeing right now. You've got the Rays playing pretty well in their somewhat new look, new home situation that where they still find ways to succeed. I think the Rays, honestly, have been probably the second most impressive team to me so far in the division after the Red Sox.
You mentioned the Red Sox there. They come in here Tuesday for a three-game set. The Jays offense gets to try to get right against Garrett Crochet and his 1.95 ERA and his big new contract. What have you seen from Crochet in the early going here? And I know it was a couple weeks ago now, but we haven't had a chance to ask you about that big, big extension he got from the Red Sox here. Heading into really his, I guess, just his first season with a no innings cap, kind of unfettered, hey, you're a full-time starter, let's go.
Well, it's interesting, Blake, because you go back to last year at the deadline, and there was so much conversation about would he get traded, and if he did get traded, would there be a governor on his innings unless he got an extension? There's a lot of back and forth about that. And yet the way that he has begun this season has affirmed that perhaps his agent and Garrett handled it the right way. As much controversy as they dealt with last year, they got him to a great organization that has now extended him, and he's shown with the way that he's pitched that he can be an elite starter. Maybe you think about great starters in the American League on the left side. There's Skubal. Crochet's probably right there beside him in terms of the most dominant left-handed starters in the league. And the Red Sox, for that reason, you think about Giolito coming back. They have to like the way this rotation is going to look once they're all there and healthy. But I think, Blake, what you've seen from Crochet is the elite high-end stuff. I mean, that is an explosive arm with a high-end fastball. I think that the breaking pitches have always been there in elite. I think the ability for him to round out the repertoire with a quality third pitch, we've seen that now too. To be able to succeed at Fenway as a left-handed starter, you have to have a pretty good repertoire, because otherwise you're going to face a whole bunch of righties that are just going to go for the wall. And I think his stuff is so split neutral, if you will, that certainly right-hand hitters have had their struggles against him, and I'll be really curious to see how Vlad and Bo approach Crochet. And he's another guy where if you don't come up to the plate with a good plan, and I listened a lot to your show last week about that issue, and you think about facing, honestly, some fairly average pitching in the Astros that the Jays made look really good. If they go up there with that kind of approach against Crochet, they'll get carved up, and it won't be much of a competition.
Yeah, it's early to start talking about these things, but when you think ahead to, could Crochet be in the Cy Young mix? It's like, well, it looks like it early on, except then, like, 2 through 6 on the ballot is the entire Detroit Tigers rotation and a couple of their relievers. I'm pivoting to the Tigers because I know you're a Detroit guy. This is the latest in a season they've been in first in the AL Central since, I think, 2014. They're 18-10. They actually have the best record in the entire American League, building on that really fun 2024 last year where it was bullpen day, bulk reliever, Tyler Holden in any possible role you could possibly be in. What have you made of the Tigers' hot start and just how sustainable it is with that level of pitching depth that they have?
Yeah, Blake, it's really interesting because you think about the way they won last year down the stretch, those magical final 6 weeks of the regular season. You're right. It was a lot of Skubal and Cater Montero and then bullpen games and a lot of creativity. But the thing about now that makes it feel more sustainable is that down the stretch last year, Jack Flaherty was a Dodger. He, of course, is now back in Detroit. And then Reese Olson wasn't really fully healthy last year down the stretch. And he is quietly, under the radar, one of the more intriguing right-handed starters in the American League. And so you've added two really good starters for either health or acquisition purposes, Flaherty and Olson, to the group to begin the year, and in addition to having Skubal. And then you've got Jobe, who's taken a big step. Mize is starting to show his potential. Torkelson has anchored the lineup. So I'm a big believer that when you pitch this well, it is sustainable. And now what I'm going to be curious to see with Scott Harris and Jeff Greenberg in the front office is how do you add to this group? Because if you're ever going to add to your core and really go for it at the trade deadline, you should do it when two things are true. When you've got good, healthy, inexpensive pitching, check, and a pretty good chance already to make the playoffs, to where the acquisitions are not just to get you into the playoffs, but get you through the playoffs. And the American League Central, with the way that, you know, the Royals have been okay to start the year, Cleveland's still an excellent ball club, but the Twins are really disappointing, and the White Sox are the White Sox. And so you look at your road ahead and say, you know what? We got a pretty good chance to make the playoffs here. This is when you invest in your core, when you already, by the way, have one of the best farm systems in the game. So the Tigers are a team that I'm buying stock in for the next 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, they've got a chance to be really good for a long time based on how young their core is. They've got Max Clark in the minor leagues. McGonigal's been injured, but I really like his bat. So it's a pretty good time right now, I think, to be the Tigers. And on the flip side, the Twins are a team that I'm looking at as being a potential clear seller. Pablo Lopez came back and started Friday. He looked really good. They seem to be stuck for me, Blake and Julia, to where the Twins should sell, and they've got some assets to sell, especially in someone like Pablo Lopez, who's under control for multiple years and has shown already he's one of the best pitchers in the American League.
The other one I'd be fascinated is Yoan Duran, where if he's getting expensive through arbitration next year and the Twins don't want it, hey, we're not good right now, we don't want to invest $8-9 million in a closer, what could you get for one of the best and most established closers at the deadline? They are a fascinating team to watch. That's a lot of great stuff on the Tigers' elite pitching. The only team in baseball with a better team ERA than the Tigers is the Mets. And I pivot to the Mets, John, because I know it's the MLB Network showcase game this week. Poor Diamondbacks. You play nothing but NL West teams. You're in fourth in the NL West because you keep having to play the Padres and the Dodgers and the Giants, and you get a non-divisional game. Here's the New York Mets, the top team in all baseball. How much are you looking forward to this one on MLB Network Showcase this Wednesday?
Really excited, Blake, and thanks for the question. I'm heading there to New York tomorrow. I may find a way to watch a little bit of the Knicks and Pistons once I get there, but we'll be on fully on baseball on Wednesday. You're right. The D-backs, and by the way, the Eugenio Suarez four-homer game, we could do a whole hour on that. How rare is it that the guy that hits four homers has a batting average under 200? Only Gino, as he's known. That's his clubhouse nickname. He's I really enjoy Eugenio a lot, a great guy. But you look at the Mets and their pitching staff. What I like about teams that are well-constructed and have a big budget, to me, Blake and Julia, is that the Mets do the big things well, like signing Soto and bringing back Alonso at a very reasonable number. They've got Lindor in a long-term deal, and he is having one of his best starts of the season ever. So despite the fact they lost that series to the Nationals over the weekend, you think about Senga bouncing back healthy. That's been a huge story for them. And they've been able to bring together this rotation without having to spend necessarily a ton of money to do it. So, like, I love the pitching staff. I think it's a well-balanced, somewhat, at least relative to the three big superstars in the lineup, a bit of an unheralded rotation that's performing very well. It makes for a really good story. David Stearns is an excellent president of baseball operations. I think this is very much his kind of a team. And you look at the National League East. You know, as you were talking about the concerns in the bullpen or Duran being a good fit, the Phillies are a team that could certainly do that. Because Romano has struggled, because that's been the issue of their team now for a while, has been a bit of a leaky bullpen for Rob Thompson, the great resident of Stratford, Ontario. So I think we're going to see potentially the Phillies be active at the deadline. Duran's a good fit there, but I love the Mets, and I can't wait to be there. Citi Field's been rocking. It's been like an October-like atmosphere for them. You'd have to say, among the NL heavyweights that have made a lot of moves the last couple off seasons, the Mets are off to a much better start than the Dodgers, who with Glasnow's early exit are looking at yet another significant pitching injury in LA.
Yeah, that's the Glasnow thing, really unfortunate, because it seems like it's been maybe a year of this now. It just, you know,
several even.
And it's not one thing. It's different injuries popping in and out, and it's kind of, you know, a bad development for a Dodgers team that has been kind of just okay since they came out of that no stars. They've been 10-10 since, and starting pitching is a big part of that, right? How do you see the depth for the Dodgers right now?
Well, Julia, it's an excellent question. It's a really important point, and you're right. Glasnow, unfortunately, he now has that adjective of injury prone. That's what the numbers say. It's what the history says. It's difficult really to argue the counterpoint to that. Blake Snell is still on the injured list. They're fortunate that they'll get Tony Gonsolin back this week. That's huge. He has not started a game in the major league since 2023. I'm a believer, I know, and Tom Verducci said this on our broadcast last week. We were doing the Cubs and Dodgers at Wrigley. Ben Kasperius should probably be a starting pitcher in this rotation right now. He has been solid in a bulk role. He's been giving them, whether it's 3-plus innings in some instances, he was the one that came on in relief of Glasnow. He's valuable in the role that he's got at the moment, but he also is pitching well enough to start. And remember, the key thing for this team is that both Yamamoto and Sasaki have been getting not just 5 days of rest, but six. So basically, you're having to have a 6-plus man rotation just to get through, and Dave Roberts is put in a situation where he doesn't have a full complement of starting pitchers to go to. It's, you start doing the math here, and it's, okay, Yamamoto's been great, but he has extra bonus rest all the time. Sasaki, May has been pretty decent to begin the year, but then you're starting to go down the list, and you need help all of a sudden. And Kershaw's not ready yet. Otani's not even close to being ready yet. It's not a good situation. The Dodgers right now, Julia, are the only team in baseball that have not had a single start on regular rest, which is defined as 4 days. Zero starts the entire season on regular rest. We talk about the Tigers last year late not being sustainable. It's more sustainable than what the Dodgers have been. They actually had the fewest number of starts last year on regular rest of any team in baseball and still won the World Series. Okay, you did it once. I would just not try this at home doing it back-to-back years. And by the way, the guys that were going on regular rest towards the end were Jack Flaherty, who no longer is there, or even a Walker Buehler, not there anymore. I've got a lot of worries right now about the way the Dodger rotation is setting up.
And if you were looking at the depth entering the season, even with all those guys on the IL, I would have thought, well, you have Landon Knack and Bobby Miller at AAA. They're 27 and 26. They're not really prospects anymore. They both have good minor league track records. And every time they get called up, it's just not there. Landon Knack has, I guess last year he was okay here and there, but he struggled. I will never understand why Bobby Miller throws 98 and can't get anyone out when he comes up to the major, or can't even strike guys out of AAA right now either. I don't understand that one. You talk about interesting trade deadline stuff. Maybe someone's like, we'll fix Bobby Miller as a as a seller or something like that. There was also, you know, this guy's not going to be available for years and years, no, but no. Pretty fun Dodgers pitching matchup the other night, too.
Yeah, you mentioned Yamamoto, but he got out-dueled on Friday night, and only someone like Paul Skeens could even say that. 9 strikeouts in that game, didn't allow a run. Obviously, everyone has bought into the Paul Skeens hype, but it's been pretty cool, John, to sort of see him continue his success and what he built on last year.
Truly, Julia, one of the best pitching prospects we've ever seen. And I know that we're often at risk of going too much with what's happening right now, but just go back in time and think about a starter who has this type of repertoire and is this polished this early in his career and is already having this level of success. And again, I go back to something I talked about with the Tigers. For the Pirates, this is the window. You've got one of the cheapest great pitchers we've ever seen in the game. So this is the time to really augment what he already brings to the team and try to make a run at things in the National League Central. But you're right. On the brightest of stages, about 50 miles from where he went to high school, El Toro High School, Lake Forest, California, playing for Mike Gonzalez, where, by the way, he was a catcher and a two-way player.
Yeah.
I was actually texting last week with his high school coach, Mike Gonzalez, who, by the way, right now, El Toro High School claims 3 fairly notable current major leaguers: Paul Skeens, Nolan Arenado, Matt Chapman. Mm. There was a time, and some would argue that's still been fairly recently the case, that arguably 2 of the 3 or 4 best third basemen in the world were on the same high school baseball team, Nolan Arenado and Matt Chapman. And Mike always told me that Nolan was playing shortstop and Matt was playing third base at that time. Nolan actually came back and played, and I know I'm going deep into the storytelling of El Toro High School, but I love this story, that Nolan, long after he'd begun his pro career, came back to play in their alumni softball game in the fall. And because Nolan was already playing, Mike Gonzalez says, listen, Nolan, I can't have you getting like a ball off the hands here and like breaking your hand, but if you want to play all-time shortstop, you can. So Mike sends me this picture. He said, here was Nolan after the game. His T-shirt just caked in dirt, just like completely. He was diving left and right for plays.
Of course.
And again, what I want to see right now is Paul Skeens facing Nolan in the El Toro High School alumni softball game with Paul Skeens on the mound. Underhand is fine, Paul. Just get out there and start pitching to Nolan and Matt Chapman. It's pretty cool what Paul Skeens is doing. And obviously, I think we may see him start for the All-Star game for the second straight year. Remarkable achievement already in his career.
That'll be awesome.
Nice to see Nolan Arenado looking a little bit back, at least defensively so far too. John, thanks so much for doing this. Great to catch up with you and enjoy, yes, Mets Diamondbacks MLB Network showcase on Wednesday, but keep us posted on where your seats are for MSG for Pistons Knicks game 5
tomorrow. I'm going to work on that. It might cost me a couple thousand to get in the building, but I don't know. We'll have to see how we do, but I appreciate it. I didn't know I was going to be doing the El Toro High School story time, but here we are, and I appreciate you both indulging me. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, John.
All the best. Thanks.
John Morosi, MLB Network, NHL Network, and hopefully good seats for Knicks Pistons game 5 tomorrow. Geez, it's baseball's such a great sport. We go through a doubleheader together yesterday and Jays Talk after, and it's just not great. And then the first segment today, and that's like, oh no, there's still so much fun stuff going on. It is just not localized here right now. A lot of fun stuff going on. The Jays, the Garrett Crochet thing's really interesting because that is not the guy you want to try to get things right against tomorrow. We'll break some of that down. Tomorrow we'll set you up for that series with Chris Cotillo on the Red Sox side. We'll go through the probables, which, by the way, on the Red Sox side are Crochet, Giolito, and Tanner Houck. On the Blue Jays side, it's all listed as TBD right now. We're pretty sure to be Bowden Francis Tuesday, Jose Berrios on Thursday, and then a question mark on Wednesday that we'll kick through tomorrow. Eric Lauer a potential option. Jake Bloss not exactly lined up, but he has had two better starts in a row. Bullpen day, also a possibility. So we'll talk about all of that. There is no game tonight. And in my excitement, I forgot the Leafs game's tomorrow, not tonight. So it's an NBA night. What are you going to do? It's an NBA night. Thanks so much to John Morosi for joining us, to Amin Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Keep an eye out. I don't think we'll get a Dalton Varsho update today. They'll wait until tomorrow. But that's another discussion point for tomorrow. Who's going down among the guys on the roster? How you feeling, Julia? Lighter day today than yesterday.
Yeah, let's get some rest.
All right. You guys all have a wonderful Monday. We'll be back tomorrow to talk to you on JSTOC Plus.